Welcome to this episode of the Insights Podcast on the Acadia Broadcasting Network. I'm Don Mills.
And I'm David Campbell.
David, a great conversation with the CEO of Nova Scotia Power, Peter Gregg. We really got a great overview of what it will take to transition to green energy in the province of Nova Scotia, and it probably will parallel what other provinces will have to go through to some extent. Although Nova Scotia faces a specific challenge that is a bit unique, and that is a transition away from coal-fired generating plants. Peter told us something that I didn't realize this, but it's an important fact. Nova Scotia currently accounts for 54% of all the electricity generated by coal in the province, yet we represent 3% of the population. And so the challenge is enormous for a small province to undertake what will be clearly a very expensive transition to green energy.
Yeah, so Nova Scotia was uniquely reliant on coal, and that has a historical reality that, of course, Nova Scotia was a producer of coal, right? We mined a lot of coal, and there's still a mine in Cape Breton. So yes, getting off of coal is a particular challenge, but they have a plan to get completely off coal by 2030, Don, and that, as you pointed out, that's 6 years away. So there's a lot of work to be done between now and then, and he lays that out for our listeners in this podcast.
Yeah, and the recent podcast we did with Premier Houston, when we talked about getting off closing coal-fired plants, he was quick to point out that the intention was not necessarily to close those plants, but perhaps to repurpose them to provide peak period grid capacity using alternative fuel sources. Most likely natural gas as a way of having those plants and those assets continue to be used while they still have lifetime. And, one of the biggest problems that Nova Scotia faces, to close these coal-fired plants means that they have what is called stranded assets that haven't been paid for, but have to be paid for by somebody. And he mentioned the fact that, the province needed help from the federal government to help transition away from coal-fired plants. And he indicated in the conversation that there had been good progress in the conversations that they've been having with the federal government on this important issue.
Absolutely. And I've said it all along, who should pay? Should it be the ratepayer or the taxpayer? And when you have taxpayer support for these projects, that's putting more of the burden on the taxpayer and less on the ratepayer. But again, this is an academic debate we won't have today, Don. But I do think if you put too much into the rates and the rates go up too high, you get a backlash from the public and then you lose momentum for addressing climate change. So that's one of the risks associated with increasing rates. And as we point out, the rates already run up 13% in Nova Scotia over the last 2 years. And as I pointed out, almost half of your households heat with oil. So not only when they shift to electricity, the rate, they're going to have to pay that higher rate on that electricity.
Yeah. And I'm a good example. I just switched from oil to an electric furnace, basically, for heating my house down the shore. And, it's for me, it was expensive because I had to pay for it. Obviously, I didn't get support. I wouldn't qualify for it. I didn't mind that. But, it's going to cost a lot of money. I think something like about 40% of households are heated by oil in the province, give or take. And, it'll be good to get off oil. It's going to happen. It's going to cost a lot of money to do that. Plus, you need the energy capacity to be able to heat those homes by electricity. So the issues around growth of capacity was part of our conversation. Peter indicated that their current forecasts expect a 60% increase in capacity by 2050, which is a big number. It's all got to come from renewals. Looks like they're counting on wind as the primary source, although I was surprised by how much Muskrat Falls is contributing to the current grid. I think he said 17%, which is a bigger number than I was expecting. So that's actually pretty good news, and obviously that's renewable as well.
Absolutely. So we talked a lot about nuclear energy, the intertie with New Brunswick, a smart grid. Anybody who wants a primer on electricity and Nova Scotia Power, Nova Scotia is going to enjoy this discussion.
Yeah, one final point that I think that's worthwhile, because we keep raising it with various people, and I raised it in the conversation with Premier Houston as well, and that is the potential of offshore wind. And it's clear that Peter recognizes the potential. They don't see themselves as being the developer of offshore wind, but certainly, being part of the transmission of the electricity generated by offshore wind. And as he stated, and as we've heard, offshore wind is almost base power because it's so consistent. And the big opportunity, and he mentioned it as well, and I don't want to lose sight of this, because it's an opportunity for all of Atlantic Canada, because we have this amazing wind resource, one of the best in the world, is that we can become a net exporter of green energy to the rest of the country, or southeastern or northeastern the U.S. I don't want us to lose sight of this. It would be costly to do, but if we could pull that off, it would mean that we would do what Alberta did with oil and gas, what Quebec did with hydropower. It would have the same overall economic impact for our region. So it's a big idea. It would take a lot of ambition to pull off, but nobody is saying it's not a good idea. It's just a question of who's going to step up to do that and take advantage of it.
Absolutely.
So with that introduction, I think you'll really enjoy our conversation with Peter Gregg, the CEO of Nova Scotia Power. Here it is. We are pleased to have Peter Gregg, the CEO of Nova Scotia Power, on this episode of the Insights Podcast. Peter, welcome to our podcast.
Thanks very much, Don.
Before we start talking about Nova Scotia Power and your current situation and future, we'd like to find a little bit more about your personal background. Can you tell our listeners a story of your career path and how you ended up as CEO of Nova Scotia Power?
Sure. I'll try not to bore everybody with that, David, as I do that. Most of my career has been spent in the energy sector. I moved to Halifax 3.5 years ago from Toronto. Most of my career, as I said before that, was in various aspects of electric utilities. I ran a system operator, chief operating officer of a large transmission distribution company, CEO of a distribution company. Probably before that, I sort of cut my teeth maybe non-traditionally, was fortunate enough to have a job on Parliament Hill back in the 90s, just got to sort of see inside policy decision making and politics at an early life. And electricity generation, transmission, distribution is a heavily regulated industry. Lots of public policy intersections. And I just mentioned that because I think, that early insight, early training has sort of been a common theme that I think has helped me navigate what has been a complex career to this date.
Yes, so certainly you're in a very interesting industry these days as we look to decarbonize in the next few decades. I wanted to ask you a little bit, just to explain to our listeners the relationship between Nova Scotia Power and Emera Inc. I think people know both, but can you just explain what that relationship is?
Sure. Well, Emera is really the parent company of us. So we're an affiliate, 100% owned by Emera. So Nova Scotia Power is owned by Emera. Emera owns other utility assets in North America, largest one of them being Tampa Electric in Florida. Also own natural gas distribution in the U.S., some other smaller assets in Canada, and some electricity distribution generation assets in the Caribbean.
And that's still headquartered in Halifax?
They're right across the street from us in downtown Halifax. Yeah, proudly grown company that is really, I think, punched above its weight on the world stage, and very, very proud of its roots here in Halifax.
So you've been the CEO of Nova Scotia Power since the fall of 2020. Let me start you with a very simple question. What have been your biggest challenges since you assumed the role of CEO?
Yeah, there, you know, frankly, it's been a busy 3.5 years. A lot has happened over that time, and I think I knew that coming here. Couldn't foresee everything, but I'd say there are probably two that I'll focus on in answering that question. One is the clean energy transition, that big path that we need to keep moving on. So we're required to be off coal-fired generation and have 80% of generation of the province produced by renewable resources by 2030. That's driven by federal policy and provincial policy, requires us to be there. That challenge was one of the big reasons I was really interested in coming to Nova Scotia and trying to lead us through that. Really complex. You know, it's going to take a lot. I think over the conversation today, we'll get into that. But we play a really important role in that. I think it's an exciting opportunity for the province to make that transition. But it is a daunting challenge. Lots of moving pieces. It costs a lot of money. So how do we make sure it's as affordable as possible for our customers as we navigate through that? But that's the one challenge. The other one I probably didn't expect as much is that the advent of more extreme weather events way more frequently. And so had the largest hurricane in Canadian history occurred, was that 18 months ago, Hurricane Fiona. We've had two tropical storms. If you think of last year, we had unprecedented floods. We had the wildfires, and we've had incredible incidents, increase of incidents in high wind events. So the last 5 years, we've seen winds, sustained winds above 80 kilometers an hour are happening 54% more frequently than they were in the previous 5 years. And so we've seen a very sharp change towards much more extreme weather. And that obviously has impacts for our customers in terms of the reliability they get from us and expect from us. And so making sure we're making the right investments in a resilient system that gives reliable service to our customer is another one of those large challenges for us.
You know, Peter, interesting enough, I mean, recently we had three major wind events in the province, and I was watching the outages in the province, yeah. And they were really quite low, given the size of those wind events. And it looks like the company has made some progress in terms of resiliency of the grid. Am I mistaken?
No, you're not mistaken. I'm glad you mentioned that, Don, that we have, I think, the investments we're making. So, you know, we're replacing poles in more prone areas with larger gauge poles that can withstand more wind. We're putting on larger gauge insulators where it makes sense. We're clearing a lot of trees. That's the biggest impact on reliability in the province is really tree contacts. So wind knocking large limbs or knocking a tree over into our lines. And so we've essentially doubled our investment in tree trimming over the last couple of years, and we'll continue that investment. And we're looking at hardening the grid, and I think you are seeing the early benefits of that type of investment over the last number of wind events that we've had.
Yeah, as you mentioned, Nova Scotia Power is a company in transition. Nova Scotia remains the largest user of coal-fired electricity in the country, yep. And as you mentioned, it's mandated to be completely off coal by 2030. Where is the company currently in terms of meeting that goal, Peter?
Yeah, we've come a long way, still a long way to go. But right now, as we sit, we're about 43%, a little above 43% of our generation comes from renewable resources. That's broken down. It's primarily wind inside the province, a little bit of solar. But also we've got a subsea cable that connects us to Newfoundland, where we get clean electrons from the Muskrat Falls Generating Station. And so when you add all those together, we're currently sitting at just above 43%. As I say, we've got to get to 80 by 2030, so there's still a long way to go. But we're working with the province, we're working with other stakeholders. We've got a plan, and I'm sure we'll talk about that some more, but a plan that sees us achieving that goal of 80% renewable by 2030. Not a lot of time left. I have a little countdown clock in my office that I look at all the time, and it's got 2,118 days for us to make the transition. And that's just a little bit of motivation for me and the team to make sure we're focused on everything we need to do. So we've made some good progress, but still much more to do.
Yeah, you mentioned a little over 40%. You have to get to 80% in 6 years.
Correct.
That seems like a very tall order. Are you looking at other sources of renewable energy rather than just wind and solar?
Well, really, it's going to be a portfolio of solutions that's going to get us there. And so maybe I'll talk a bit about that. There will be a lot more wind. We're blessed with really good wind in Nova Scotia. And so the predominant new source to achieve that 80% is going to be more wind. We've got approximately 600 megawatts of installed capacity on the system now. Between now and 2030, the province will procure another 1,000 megawatts of wind. There'll be some solar along the side of that too. We're investing in battery storage. The battery storage on the grid will enable more of that renewable energy to be put onto the system. That's a big part of it. We're building a transmission tie line, a new tie line between us and New Brunswick. That's really for reliability needs, but it's an important step on the journey to 2030. It won't all be renewable. We're going to need, it may sound counterintuitive, but we're going to need some more natural gas-fired generation on the system. And the reason we need that is we need a local resource of really high capacity generation. So when the wind doesn't blow and when the sun doesn't shine, and that's typically, you know, late January, early February, we get a cold snap. We get some really cold nights, not a lot of wind, and there's no solar. And so we need to have that very infrequently used, but locally sourced reliability generation in place. We're going to have to put that there. And then some of our existing plants that currently burn coal, there'll be a mix there. Some of them will leave the system entirely. Some of them have the ability to burn oil. And some of them can be converted to natural gas. There'll be a mixture of that. And again, those plants, while we'll need them for reliability purposes, while they're not renewable, they'll be used very, very infrequently. Really, we're a cold weather energy peaking jurisdiction. And so we need to have that available to make sure the light stays on and the heat stays on for our customers.
So yeah, just to confirm that then. So you're going to have 80%, you're going to have zero coal by 2030.
Yes.
But you're still going to have 20% fossil fuel, and that'll be a mix of oil and gas depending on a variety of factors.
Yeah, right now that's currently the plan. We do every year we do an integrated resource plan. So we look at all available technologies that are out there, look at their cost. And really look at policy objectives like the 2030 one to say what's the least cost way of getting to those objectives. And what I just described is really the least cost way. The interesting thing, though, about natural gas is that as we look to convert existing systems or build new, there is an opportunity to have some flexible fuel capability in those plants. So there's a lot of talk about green hydrogen in this province, and those plants will be able to burn green hydrogen when it becomes economically feasible to do so. So natural gas in the near term, because it's really the only affordable and reliable fuel source we've got now, but that is changing. And so either through a blend of hydrogen when it's available or 100% green hydrogen of the future, that would be the plan, is to move. And on the oil plants too, what we're looking at is using things like biodiesel or bio oils that we could put in those, that it would be a renewable resource.
Did you look at all at torrefied pellets?
We do look at that. And I should mention a small piece of the renewable supply is going to continue to be biomass. We do have biomass plants in the province, and that will continue to be the case. We're not looking at expanding the biomass capability, but it does play an important, but you know, relatively small piece of the journey towards 80%.
We wanted to ask you about those coal-fired plants. Some of them at least are being closed or proposed to be closed before their sort of normal operational life. So I don't know if you still have debt against them, but we wanted to ask you if there's stranded costs, and then you know, what happens with those plants? Is there significant decommissioning costs and so on?
Yeah, the details of that we're working through. There is the risk of stranded cost. And I guess, you know, the big picture on this is that, you know, we're fully supportive of the move away from coal. We know what has to happen. And we're fully supportive of the policy to move to more renewables. It's important, though, to remember that that's a costly journey. And so we've got to be really careful as a province, and Nova Scotia Power has a role to play in that. But frankly, it is bigger than us, is to do that in a prudent and responsible way. And so there's a risk of stranded cost as we do that. So we're looking at, you know, maintaining a few of those plants to burn alternate fuels where it makes sense and get the economic value out of those plants that is there. But there is some risk of that stranded cost, and we'll need to be creative in terms of making sure that, you know, financially we remain sustainable as a business, because I think, you know, our customers certainly need the service we provide, but are mindful of the affordability impact on our customers as well. And so it's, you know, I talk a lot about there's going to be, maybe the stat I like to use is that, so Canada has set the policy for us to be off coal. So it's a national ambition. We're doing our part, and you made the comment off the top that, you know, we're the highest use jurisdiction in Canada for coal. But when you look at the cost of getting off coal nationally, 55% of that burden is in Nova Scotia because of the historical reliance on coal. But we're 3% of the population. And so what we've been saying is we need some help. And we do think there's a role for the federal government in this to help us out. We've been having some meaningful discussions with the federal government on that in terms of direct financial support to help make that transition as affordable as possible. And I think we've had some early successes there, but there's still much more that needs to be done. And those conversations are continuing, but time's ticking and we're feeling some urgency that we need to solve for that affordability challenge as we move towards 2030.
Yeah, you've been stating for some time publicly that you are seeking federal assistance in the transition from coal. How much assistance are you seeking from the federal government, Peter?
Well, as much as we can. But I think the discussions we've been having, we don't expect a blank check. I don't think anybody can go in and say, you know, federal government, you just need to give us a blank check and pay for the whole thing. I think we're going to need to find a way that you know, we as Nova Scotians pay our fair share for the transition. But that the federal government has a meaningful role to play there too. So I think it'll be a mixture of some direct grants. We've seen some benefit of that in some of our early projects. We've got some direct grant funding. We'll seek more of that. The Canada Infrastructure Bank is an important piece of this too. So we've been working really closely with the CIB on low-cost financing for a number of these projects. And I think that will play a critical role in the future. So I think it'll be a use of some existing programs, some grant funding, some low-cost financing. Investment tax credits have been, you know, we saw that in the federal budget from last year. We're still awaiting some of the details as to exactly how those ITCs will work, but those will play a really important role. I'm reluctant to always put a dollar figure on it because those dollar figures tend to change over time, but it's a significant amount of financial support that we're seeking.
So are we talking hundreds of millions of dollars?
We're talking, we're in the billions of dollars for sure.
Billions. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So obviously, if this assistance does not materialize, there's going to be a major impact on ratepayers. Do we have any idea what the likely impact of electricity rates would be if you don't get that assistance? I know I don't want to scare people, but I mean, we also need to have a real conversation, right?
Probably the best way of having that conversation is that it's one of these things that the industry struggles with. It's we call it the energy trilemma. And so sort of summarize part of this conversation we've had already is that utilities like us are trying to decarbonize for sure. That's one leg of the stool. trying to maintain and enhance reliability under more challenging circumstances, and trying to manage customer affordability at the same time. And it really is a trilemma to try to manage together those three factors, because many of them are in direct opposition to one another. And that's really the challenge for us, and many of our colleagues across North America are facing the same thing. And I think it's back to why I think we need that level of support from the federal government to make this affordable. So I'm confident we will get that support. That will enable us to do it, and enable it to be an affordable journey for our customers. But we've got to continue working those conversations with the federal government. And again, as I say, confident that we can find a path through.
Now, your ratepayers have already invested in power from Muskrat Falls, as you referred to earlier, through higher electricity rates for sure. There's a significant delay in the access. There was a significant delay in the access to that power, as we all know. What is the current status of the power from Muskrat Falls, and how will this power help stabilize electricity rates in the province over the long term?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there was a delay on the Newfoundland side in terms of commissioning the Muskrat Falls generating station. Our piece of that, the Emera piece of that, was to have the subsea cable in place to deliver that energy. And that was done on time and on budget, just an important point to make. And there was a period where the energy wasn't flowing because of that delay on the Newfoundland side. But I'm pleased to report that since commissioning, I think almost 2 years ago, we've been seeing some very, very robust flows over that link, and continue to see robust flows over that link. And I think it's important to say too that this is really a generational investment. It's a 35-year contract that's in place there, and for any undelivered energy. So when the delay happened and we weren't getting that energy, they're required to deliver that energy over the term of the agreement. So it's not like it was lost energy. Would it have been nice to have it earlier? Absolutely, it would have been. But it doesn't mean we lost that. That will always be delivered to us. And so I think when you look at the 43% renewable we're at right now, big piece of that is coming from the Maritime Link, that clean electrons coming down from Newfoundland. That's a big piece of it. And I'm really pleased to say that it has been robust. We see continued really good performance on that link. I looked at a study recently that showed that, so that's a high voltage direct current link. And there are a number of those sort of subsea cables around the world, and ours is performing in the top decile of those types of pieces of infrastructure around the world. And we're quite proud of that.
So what percentage of the power is coming from Muskrat Falls right now? Can you put a percentage on it?
It's approximately 17%. So when I talk about 43% of renewable right now, that flow from Newfoundland is 17 of that 43.
And we didn't mean to ask this question, but there's been obviously you talk about the an Atlantic loop that has now gone sideways. With the idea of Newfoundland taking back their power from Quebec in the not too distant future. Tapping into that possibility. What's the position of the company on the Atlantic Loop today?
We did investigate the Atlantic Loop with our partners in New Brunswick and our partners in Quebec. And the federal government was quite involved in that discussion as well. But after that investigation, we sort of took a look at, again, we do this integrated resource planning and look for the lowest cost opportunities. Yeah. And as we examined that more, the complexity of that project, the scale of that project, and the cost increases in that project led us to look at an alternative path. And that's now called the Clean Power Plan. It's the province's Clean Power Plan. That is that portfolio of 1,000 megawatts plus of new wind, new tie line to New Brunswick, grid scale batteries on the system, some solar, the gas plant additions and conversions of coal plants. This past year, we've shifted to that as a more achievable and more affordable way to do it. The other issue with large infrastructure like that piece of transmission, as the time gets nearer to 2030, being able to actually deliver that size of infrastructure over three different jurisdictions became less and less feasible. I do think at some point, like the general trend in the industry is more transmission connections to different jurisdictions is a big strategic advantage. And moving clean electrons from where they're best produced to those who really need them is going to be a trend. So I do think you'll see more transmission connections as we look to the decades ahead.
You mentioned earlier that the new intertie with New Brunswick is really for, I guess you called it redundancy.
Reliability.
Reliability, yeah. Sorry. Is there potential in the future of importing from New Brunswick?
Sure. Sure. That's not the reason that we're building that tie line. It's for a little bit of import. So basically what we're saying is that, you know, if we're in a tight situation, we've got a high level of demand on our side and we need it, we can bring a little bit over that tie line, but it's not primarily for import purposes. And vice versa, New Brunswick can rely on us in their times of need as well. But does it create an alternate pathway for that future eventuality? Yes, it does.
So one of the things that's quite unique about Nova Scotia and Prince Edward Island, and this is not on the question list, so I apologize in advance, but I wanted to ask you about heating oil. Yes. Almost half of the households in Nova Scotia heat with oil. And of course, there is a federal, I don't know what the dates are on that, maybe you can help us, but there is a plan to phase out heating oil as a source by 2035 or by some time, or at least there's some sort of guideline there.
Yes.
How does that impact your plan? Now you're going to have to help 205,000 households now heat with electricity that were previously heating with oil. That's going to create a lot more demand, I would assume, for you.
Yes, it does generally, but we've factored that into our planning. So we've anticipated that, and we've worked closely with the province and the federal government on that. Some really good policies in place and some really good direct grant funding available from the federal government that allow low and medium income Nova Scotians actually pretty much in many cases cover the whole cost of that shift to heat pumps, electric heat pumps, and away from fuel oil. And so we think it's a very good thing. It's always a very good thing when people want more of the product you're selling, and we're selling electrons. And so that is a good thing, but we built that into the plan. And, you know, over that same time period, or maybe out to 2040, we're going to need to have more electrons on the system. And that's really the plan I talked about the more wind being added and all the other pieces of the puzzle. We'll add that additional capacity onto the system as well.
We're going to talk later, ask you later about EVs, but I'm just thinking all this, these new, you know, heating of all these new homes, plus all the EVs and everything else is going to put a lot of stress on the wires and the actual grid itself. So I suspect you're going to have to, and you've probably factored that in, but you're going to have to invest a lot in the actual infrastructure.
Yeah, it's true. And really on the wire side, both the high voltage transmission, but really what you're talking about when you're looking at sort of home use, so people switching to electric vehicles, solar panels on roofs, either using the battery in the car or battery attached to the house, it's allowing for what used to be one-way flow of power from a generating station down to the end-use consumer. You're now getting bidirectional flows. And so, yes, you know, there's more investment requirement into those wires over time, but there's some real reliability benefit from that for our customers as well. So if locally we can rely on those resources, somebody's got a fully charged car in their garage at a time when we need it, if we can send a price signal to them, say, hey, we'll buy that power back from you for your neighbors and you to use, or by that solar energy from your roof, it creates a very different system, yes, but it creates that sort of more local reliability as well. So yes, investment requirements, but we see some real benefits to our customers as well.
So my Tesla's going to heat my neighbor's house. That's kind of cool. wanted to ask you about the rate increase. Of course, the URB recently granted the company a 13% increase, I believe, over the current year and next year. Can you give us a sense of where electricity rates are in general in Nova Scotia compared to the rest of Atlantic Canada?
Sure. And so just on that, you're partially right, but it was last year and this year that the rate increases took effect. Okay. So no increase for next year has been approved. when you look at the Canadian context, you see quite a range of electricity prices across the country. The highest rates are generally in Alberta, and I would say by a margin, significantly more expensive. And then you go to places like Quebec that have been blessed by certain types of geography. We've got a lot of hydro energy in their geography, tend to see lower rates. And when you look at Atlantic Canada, I'd say comparable to our neighbors in Atlantic Canada, but really interesting to look just south of the border. So we always compare to Atlantic provinces, and as I say, comparable. But when we look to places like Maine and Massachusetts, we've got rates down there that are double and sometimes triple what they are here. And very similar systems. So seeing similar weather patterns, similar geography in terms of what types of resources are available to them, not a lot of hydro, relying on the same types of generation sources. And so when you look at it from that context, while some, you know, I'm always mindful that our customers need to have an affordable rate. We're very, very focused on that. But there are other jurisdictions that are certainly much more expensive than ours.
One of the things that's always sort of I've been thinking about is who should pay for the clean energy transition. Should it be the taxpayer or the ratepayer? Because the ratepayer, the taxpayer, you know, incomes are taxes are graduated based on how much income you have, whereas the ratepayer is not. And I'm not, I don't necessarily want you to weigh in on that, but you've talked earlier about the federal support for this. And the question we have here is, how do you balance that? Like, how do you keep electricity rates both competitive and affordable for Nova Scotians, but at the same time push through this aggressive, you know, decarbonization of your grid?
Well, I think it's going to be a sort of a portfolio of solutions. And I think you're right to talk about it's public policy, so it's not a utility decision, but that split between what should be covered by the ratepayer and what should be covered by the taxpayer. And you see other jurisdictions have taken different approaches. Where I come from, in Ontario, they transitioned to renewables in the last 15 years. And all of that initially went on to utility bills. And there was a bit of a backlash on that, created a bit of a political firestorm. And then the decision was made that I think with the rationale being that there's general public benefit from that transition, and therefore the taxpayer should fund that. And so a large part of that cost to move away from fossil fuels and on to renewables became shifted to the tax base. And then there was a corresponding decrease in electricity rates. And so that's an active debate in many jurisdictions. And I think it fits into what I was saying earlier is our request for help from the federal government is saying that really it is the Canadian taxpayer who should pay for a portion of this, not all of it, but a portion of this to keep those electricity bills in Nova Scotia as affordable as possible.
The company has announced that it will be introducing time of day rates soon. When do you anticipate that being done, and what impact would time of day rates have on electricity costs, Peter?
So, we've been investing in some pilot programs for the last few years with our customers in certain parts of the province. So smaller scale pilots. We've got two primarily. One is called a time of use pilot. So customers on that pilot can see lower cost electricity at typically in the overnight period or in the evening period or early morning, rather than during the sort of early morning period or the dinner time period where there's more demand. And then there's also a critical peak plan. When we look at the average of those pilot programs, customers on the time of use plan have saved an average of $90 a year on their electricity bills. And on the critical peak plan, they've saved an average of close to $400 a year. So we are seeing some meaningful savings from that shifting of your use patterns, giving you price signal to shift your use patterns. And so we'd like to broaden that out. So we're just finalizing sort of the learnings of that, of those pilot programs. And once we have the more detailed results, we hope to offer the option to more of our customers in the near future. I don't have a date I can share with you at this point, but we'd like to get that to our customers as quickly as we can.
Of course, one of the benefits of that is on sort of supply and demand. You don't have to build sure. as much if Correct. You can move the use of electricity to off-peak periods. So there's obviously a benefit to the company that way.
Absolutely.
Clearly, with rapidly increasing population, which is something we're not used to in Nova Scotia, as you know,
yep.
the transition to electrical vehicles and the development of large-scale projects like green hydrogen, you know, the demand for electricity is going to increase no matter what now going ahead. Time of day rates, you know, reduce the peak loads, as I mentioned. Recently at a chamber event, you indicated the company would have to increase its generating capacity by, if I've got this number right, 60% by 2050.
Correct.
So what are the company's early plans to increase capacity, and what are the costs associated with those plans? Because, you know, building capacity is expensive, right?
It is, but I think, you know, really important, the last conversation we just had around those shifting of use, you made the really valid point that better optimizing the system you've got today is the best use, and what our customers expect for us to do. So those types of programs will play a really important part of shifting demand to the lower demand periods and optimizing the system that's already in place and paid for. So that's hugely, hugely important. And other demand side programs, we work closely with Efficiency One on demand side programs for our customers. As I mentioned before too, you know, when we do our long range planning, making sure that, you know, we are installing that capacity we need. So between now and 2035, we've got a good handle on what we're going to need to satisfy that demand. As we move closer to 2050, you're right that the current projection is showing 60% new capacity. We're not going to put that into place now. We're going to put that in place when it's really closer to being needed. We don't want to overbuild the system and have our customers pay for that unnecessarily. So we'll have to really manage that over time. And that number may shift, right? New technologies come online. We'll take advantage of those. But right now, our view is that it's going to be 60% new capacity by that time. And so there's the installation of new, there's optimizing the existing system, there's ongoing demand-side management programs and time-of-use programs that are all going to be part of the puzzle we're trying to solve.
You know, the premier, we had him on recently, and, you know, he's sticking to his goal of doubling the population by 2060. The good news, there's good news. Well, there's always, it's all good news for Nova Scotia Power.
Yeah.
It means that your business is going to increase dramatically. But from my point of view, we also will have almost double the number of people to help pay for, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, people forget about that element that, yeah, the capacity is going to increase by 60%, but
completely right.
Over that period of time, if we double the number of people who can pay for it, that helps on the cost side dramatically, right?
It very much does. Having that sort of denominator grow helps pay
right.
for the whole total system. But, you know, really, really careful planning is a big part of it too. So back to the point of saying we generally know what it's going to look like, and we have an obligation to make sure that power is going to be there when our customers need it. So we need to plan for that. But again, we've got to be careful not to overbuild and overplan and put too much burden on our customers. So careful
right.
expert planning of making sure the assets are there when our customers need them. That's going to be a big, big piece of the challenge for us as well. But really proud. We've got some really, really smart people here who are used to looking at those things and making those decisions. So confident we can get there.
We recently had Peter Nicholson, the author of Catching the Wind Report, published by the Public Policy Forum, on the podcast. He was advocating for a massive, large-scale development of offshore wind to help Nova Scotia and Atlantic Canada become an energy superpower. I guess we wanted to ask you about offshore wind in general. What do you think about it? Do you think it's will it help Nova Scotia meet Nova Scotia's power needs? But also, where do you see yourself as a company in that potential development?
Sure. I know Peter. Got a lot of respect for Peter. And I read the report, and it's a fascinating report, frankly. I encourage people to read it. I personally think that offshore wind is a huge opportunity for Nova Scotia, for Nova Scotia as a province. I think it's a huge opportunity. And I agree with what Peter says in the report. We've got to make sure we capture it properly. I think from a Nova Scotia power perspective, I don't anticipate we will be the ones building and owning the offshore turbines to generate that power. I think that'll be done by independent power producers. There's a role for us to play in terms of the wires that are needed to bring that onshore and to distribute it across the province. There's definitely a role for us to play there, and that's how we're looking at it. But I think when you stand back and look at what I've seen offshore is one of the best wind resources that exists in the world from the early studies that are out there. It's got a very high capacity factor that is close to a base load generating station. And there's much more of it out there than we're ever going to need as a province ourselves. So yes, we can benefit in terms of it serving our needs here, but I see a real export opportunity there, frankly, for the province. And I think that's the opportunity. And, you know, there's recent legislation brought in by provincial government that will stand up a new system operator for the province. And I think it's an important role for that new independent system operator to really think carefully about how to develop that resource and how would that benefit the province from, yes, our own needs internally, but because it's larger than what we need, how best to optimize that on behalf of Nova Scotians. I think there's a massive opportunity there.
Some of the planning indicated an undersea cable would go right from the offshore right into New England and not even touch Nova Scotia. Would you still see Nova Scotia Power having a role there, or does it make more sense to bring it onshore and then ship it over land?
We have not gotten into any kind of detailed planning studies on that yet. It's still very early days. If it was a Nova Scotia Power plan, it's much more focused on Nova Scotia. That's our home base, and that's what we're responsible for serving customers here. So we would be interested in that. Now, you mentioned our parent company before has built subsea cable between Newfoundland and Nova Scotia. Has got a lot of experience on that, and would Emera perhaps, and there would be other developers as well, if there was a need to connect that wind resource directly into the eastern seaboard of the U.S. Certainly Emera's got demonstrated capability of doing that, but I don't think anybody's actively pursuing that at this point.
You recently made a submission to the UARB to build battery storage capacity. You've talked a little bit about that earlier. Can you tell us a little bit more about that initiative?
Sure. I'm really excited about that project. I'm really proud of that project. It's one of the, we talk about the path to 2030 decarbonization. That's a really meaningful piece. So we need 150 megawatts of grid scale battery storage. So these are large, if you know what a transformer station looks like, where we've got our transformers with the fences around them, essentially same size as that, but it'll have battery banks in them. And they're having three of those sites in different places around the province, 50 megawatts each. And really, they're there for reliability needs, but also they play a key role of stabilizing the grid when we bring much more variable generation from wind and solar on. So essential for that next tranche of 1,000 megawatts of wind to come on the system, these need to be in the place to allow that to happen. So really critical step. And innovative approach. And when we go back to, we talked earlier about how do we pay for these? How do we find solutions that solve for the trilemma that I talked about before? This is an interesting example of that. And so we worked closely with the federal government, and we were able to secure $111 million of direct grant funding from Natural Resources Canada. So that's a direct cost reduction for this project. We then worked with the Canada Infrastructure Bank and secured very low cost interest rate debt for the project that adds another $100 million of value to the project. And then we're funding the rest of it through the utility. And the other piece that I'm really proud of is we approached all 13 Mi'kmaq communities here in Nova Scotia and said, we'd be really interested in having you in as equity partners in this. And we've been really working on our relationship with the Mi'kmaq for years. And we saw this as a natural next step in that relationship. It's one thing to talk, but resource development, but to have the Mi'kmaq in as partners is important to us, and I think a big important strategic move for us, and we're really proud of that. So we've got all 13 communities participating at an equity level in that project.
That's great. Just one quick follow-up on the grid scale battery. Is there a role? We talked earlier about the Tesla heating the neighbor's home, but is there a role for smaller scale stuff like in home, like me having a battery in my basement, and if you can't supply on a February morning, my battery kicks in, or is it better to do it at the grid?
So both is the answer. I think we're going to see both of that. So at the high voltage level, we're going to need this to enable the wind to come on and to maintain grid stability. But when it comes to home, I think you'll see much more use of batteries in the future. So it's a part of our Smart Grid Nova Scotia pilot program. We've been doing exactly that, where, you know, solar panels on the roof, battery storage in the house. And really the benefit of that is if there are going to be weather interruptions, that being able to rely on a local source to power your home is a huge benefit. And so we're seeing some really great customer engagement come from that that pilot program, some really good technical results coming from that program. And we do see expanding that out to more of our customers in the not too distant future.
You mentioned that, you know, you're going to upgrade the tie line between Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, mainly for reliability purposes. But I'm wondering, you know, that's probably an expensive project. How much is that project going to cost?
Current estimate on that is approximately $700 million.
Yeah, so that's
a 96-kilometer line, $700 million estimate.
And that would be shared between Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, would it?
It's probably most of the cost will be for Nova Scotia because most of the benefit of that line is Nova Scotia. But haven't entirely nailed all the aspects of that down. Still early stages. That project did approve environmental assessment, so we had the corridor looked at and it has been approved. And now we're moving on to the more detailed engineering for that project.
Yeah.
And excited to move that one forward.
What's the timeline, Peter, on that?
We would like to have that line in place by the end of 2027.
As you know, Nova Scotia has had a ban on nuclear generation and the mining of uranium for decades. I asked the premier recently about this, and I was a little bit surprised that he basically said he was in favor of nuclear power and uranium mining publicly. The province has actually included nuclear power in part of its, most recent energy strategy to reduce carbon emissions. Would Nova Scotia Power consider small modular reactors if the province lifted the ban on nuclear power as a potential source of renewable energy?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So the recent legislation tabled in this current legislative sitting actually does propose to lift that ban on generation of nuclear power in Nova Scotia. So that's actively proceeding through the House now. I would say big picture, I think for the world, for Canada, for North America, for the world to achieve the broad decarbonization net zero goals, nuclear energy has to play a role in that. It'll play a significant role in that. And you're seeing jurisdictions, New Brunswick, Ontario, in a Canadian context, really relying on nuclear as part of that strategy. I think having it available as an option for planning makes a lot of sense to me. We will look at it as part of our longer range planning. And now there's going to be a system operator set up that will actually do that longer range planning. And they will look at that and make a determination. But I guess the big question, so we're not at this point pursuing small modular reactors as part of our strategy. It is not part of the clean power plan to get us to 2030. It just would take too long for us to get there. Ontario Power Generation is the farthest ahead in Canada with their SMR at Darlington, and they expect to have it in service around 2029. New Brunswick will follow that, but again, it'll be a post-2030, maybe a 2035 timeframe. So I think we'll continue to watch for it. one of the biggest challenges for nuclear is getting greenfield site approval to build. That is a lengthy and complex process to do it. So again, the way I like to think about it, with more transmission connections to New Brunswick, New Brunswick has plans to develop small modular reactors on an existing nuclear site at LaProbe. Would it make more sense, likely does, to when they're producing those electrons, to actually bring those electrons across a transmission line to help solve the problem in Nova Scotia. That's probably the solution as we look to that longer range planning rather than building here, but I would never say never.
So we talked earlier about the reliability, and your one of your two big issues, of course, is extreme weather that we talked about in the very first question. Can you give us a little more insight into what you're doing to improve reliability? Is it just a matter of cutting down trees, or are there other things that you're doing to improve reliability?
Yeah, it's a huge focus, and I know our customers want it to be a huge focus for us. We hear that from our customers. The weather's getting worse, more severe storms, wind that we talked about before. So we're investing in a number of different areas. This year, we'll spend approximately $230 million across the province. That's up from $180 million on various reliability investments. I talked earlier about larger gauge poles, stronger conductor, and yes, tree trimming. As part of that, $230 million is tree trimming. We've essentially doubled our budget for tree trimming and are going at that more aggressively and smarter. And those investments we think are critical to solving the reliability challenge. We're committed to continuing that, confident that that we can make some improvements there for sure.
So I'll turn it back to you, Don.
Yeah, I always wondered about this, Peter. And in fact, when I used to do some work with Nova Scotia Power when I owned my company, we talked about the idea of becoming a supplier of backup power generation for customers, because at that point there was very little of it. Now, of course, there's a lot of products out in the marketplace. I use a backup generator for my property down the shore. It really takes the pressure off worrying about power. I just wondered is there a business case for Nova Scotia Power to get into that business to provide that kind of backup system for its customers?
I think there certainly can be. It's something we're looking at. I wouldn't say it's part of our direct plans of the moment, but it's something we think about and look at. And so I think the way I think about it is that the regulatory construct that is here with the UARB requires us to bring forward solutions for our customers that are the lowest cost solutions. And so, as you mentioned, as that technology is changing and getting better, if we can put a business case forward, particularly in the more rural areas where rather than stringing a whole new line down to serve a handful of customers, if we can actually demonstrate that a combination of generators and batteries or whatever it's going to be is more cost effective, then I think the regulator would look kindly on that. And so as we look out into the future, we're looking at those types of solutions. I mentioned Smart Grid Nova Scotia as a pilot program we're looking at now. It does utilize batteries in homes. That's a potential solution that we can roll out to more customers in the future. So I think we're going to need to look at all of those tools in a more complex world. With more extreme weather, we need to be creative. We need to be innovative. Our customers expect that, and we will bring those types of solutions forward.
Obviously, one of the advantages is that when the power goes out, people get antsy, right?
Yes, I understand.
You get a few calls coming in wondering where the power is going to come back on. The company does a pretty good job of letting people know when the restoration is going to happen. But, you know, I'm a good example. When the power goes out, I'm not worried about it. I'm not calling Nova Scotia Power and asking when the power is going to come out. So it takes a lot of pressure off the company if more people had a backup power system that they didn't worry about it going out, and then realize that with, you know, the increasing weather events that we're having, it's just the part of what we have to face, right? And we need to be able to come up with other solutions.
Yeah, but I think there's a role for us to play there in the future for sure. So we'll continue to examine that.
So just a final question. It's been a great conversation. Thanks for doing this. Looking ahead, what are the biggest challenges for your company? And let's look at the short term in the coming year. What's the focus in the coming year, Peter?
We've talked a lot about it. It's back to that energy trilemma I talked about before. The factors of decarbonizing, reliability, resiliency, and affordability. Managing those factors together. So that's going to, I think, dominate my thinking, my team's thinking and time over the coming year for sure. But I expect that to continue out to 2030 and likely beyond. So that really forces us to be thinking about, we're on a timeline to decarbonize for 2030, continue to pursue funding from the federal government as much as we can, continue to advance programs, projects like grid-scale battery and the tie line. Province will seek to procure that 1,000 megawatts plus of wind. Those things all need to happen. We need to work together to have that happen. Continue to invest the money I mentioned before in customer reliability. So upgrading where it makes sense, tree trimming, being prepared for that more extreme weather. That really is the focus. And all of that with an affordability lens. That's got to be on it for sure. And that is a tough thing, because all of what I just described takes money. So making the right investments at the right time, getting the right amount of support from federal entities, looking for creative solutions like, you know, what role can a Canada Infrastructure Bank play to lower costs, working with the regulator to find more innovative ways of maybe spreading those costs over a longer period of time. It's going to take all of those approaches to really be successful in managing that trilemma.
Right. Peter, thanks for joining us on the Insights podcast and providing such a great overview of Nova Scotia Power and its plans to transition to green energy. We'll follow the progress of your company with great interest, and we're probably going to have you back in due time to talk about the success that you will have achieved.
Well, thanks very much, Don and David. I've really enjoyed that, and I would love to come back. So thank you.
Thanks again.
You've been listening to the Insights Podcast from the Acadia Broadcasting Corporation. Follow the show and listen to past episodes on your favorite podcast platform, like Apple or Spotify. If you've enjoyed the show, why not recommend it to a friend? Don and David will be back next week with another deep dive into some key issues in Atlantic Canada.